This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, Mumia Abu-Jamal explores the meaning of Donald Trump's triumph over the Republican Party. A Black Bernie Sanders supporter tells why he's through with the Democrats. And Baltimore's political machinery is almost entirely managed by Black people, but the system hasn't been able to convict a single cop in the killing of Freddie Gray. But first, Black activists took the fight against police terror to the cops' doorstep last week. Black Youth Project 100 and Black Lives Matter DC occupied the grounds of the Fraternal Order of Police Union headquarters in Washington. At about the same time, BYP 100, Black Lives Matter, and the Million Hoodies Movement for Justice staged a sit-in at the New York City offices of another police union, the Patrolmen's Benevolent Association. Samantha Masters is a spokesperson for the activists in the nation's capital.
We took the resistance. We took our occupation of the Fraternal Order of Police in the D.C. chapter of the Black Youth Project 100 and Black Lives Matter D.C. because the FOP defends the worst officers in our country. Even in the face of overwhelming police misconduct, police officers who kill and maim civilians, including innocent civilians, are still not being held accountable. And that must stop, and the people that are protecting these killer cops are police unions.
And in fact, the FOP and other police unions are the main lobbyists who push for legislation that would give the police even more immunities from prosecution when they commit offenses.
Absolutely. The FOP invested $220,000 in 2015 to both advance Blue Lives Matter bills, which would do things like protect police officers under federal hate crimes legislation or under state hate crimes legislation, even though we know that attacks on police are at a 45-year low, but they also invested that money in stopping legislation that would hold police accountable and would ensure transparency in how police officers are held accountable when they commit violent acts against civilians. If we look at the case of Freddie Gray, we see that no one is responsible for Freddie Gray's death. Not the people who drove the van, not the officers who were in the van, not the officers who knew about it, and the officers who were involved. And it is the culture of policing that the FOP perpetuates and creates and moves forward that ensures that officers are not held accountable. And so we are taking the fight to their doorsteps.
Yes, and you're questioning that mythology about police work being somewhere near the top of the most dangerous in the country. Studies have shown that it's more dangerous to be a garbage man or a farmer.
Attacks on police are at historic lows, and so the furthering of this narrative that police are under attack is not only factually untrue, it allows police to abdicate responsibility in the ways that they ensure that police and community relations are strained or tense and are non-existent.
Now, this is not just the Black Youth 100 Project. This is a coalition of forces that's staging similar actions around the country.
Absolutely. The Black Youth Project 100 and Black Lives Matter DC were the co-organizers of that action at the National Legislative Advocacy Center at the Fraternal Order of Police. It is, if you will, an ALEC of the police unions that creates and advances model legislation to be enacted at the federal, state, and local level. However, I want to be very clear that the Fraternal Order of Police is the most dangerous fraternity in all of America. And like fraternities who perpetuate rape culture by closing ranks when their members are accused of sexual assault, the Fraternal Order of Police and police unions close ranks when police are accused of misconduct. They ensure that there is a blue wall of silence that disallows even police officers who say they are invested in justice from whistleblowing, from talking about the corrupt culture of policing, and to ensure that police officers continue to be able to have their jobs and be paid and be rewarded almost for really, really horrible acts that they commit. And so the Movement for Black Lives, which is the coalition you were talking about, is deeply invested not just in Black liberation, but in the concepts of justice, freedom, dignity, and respect that undergird what we say our American principles are. And so it is not just Black Lives Matter, which is a network of activists. It is not just the Black Youth Project 100, but it is a coalition of organizations, some of which have been around for decades and some of which are fairly new coming into this iteration of Black liberation work, who have been driving this agenda forward.
And one of your main demands is the defunding of the police.
Absolutely. And so I want to be very clear. When the Black Youth Project 100 is calling for the defunding of police and the funding and building of Black futures, that looks very specifically like investments in education that are equitable no matter one's zip code, treating crime and intra-community violence as the public health issues they are that stem from things like economic divestment, that stem from lack of access to jobs, education, and healthcare. And so investing in those systems and out of police. And so police need not be first responders to mental health crises. Trained professionals should be the first responders. And so if we divested from police and funded in more mental health care, that would be the community change that we are seeking. If we funded education that was equitable and did not penalize young people for things like truancy, but sought to figure out creative alternatives to engage young people in school and education that was culturally competent and relevant, that would be a defunding of police and a funding and a building of Black futures. If we invested in jobs programs for our community to ensure the conditions by which people felt compelled to move in underground economies like drugs or sex work, that they didn't necessarily have to use those as options for personal sustenance, and we invested in jobs programs and education, that is a defunding of police and a building and funding of Black futures, and that is the change we want.
And what about the fundamental question, who controls the police?
I think that that is a question that we are deeply grappling with. And so who controls police is a question of what are the systems in America, including white supremacy, patriarchy, heterosexism, cissexism, that really undergird the systems of oppression that manifest in the lives of young Black people. And so we know that still to this day, it is largely a culture that is bound up in the ties of slavery that inform how police operate in the United States. It informs the anti-Black police culture, and even for Black police officers, they are not immune from imbibing those messaging and those actions that centralize Black people as inherently criminal. And so when we talk about who controls police, the institutions that perpetuate white supremacy, capitalism, cissexism, heterosexism, those are the institutions that control the mindset of policing, and that and those systems ensure that Black lives don't matter. So we ended our occupation of the Fraternal Order of Police headquarters at midnight. However, this is not the only time we will be confrontational with police when it comes to ensuring Black liberation and that Black people are treated with dignity and respect. This will be a part of an ongoing series of actions to ensure that Black people are treated with fairness, dignity, respect, and are able to achieve justice. This movement is not going anywhere. We are a movement built in love, justice, resistance, and resilience, and we will continue to take our fight to those who seek to limit Black lives, who seek to end Black lives for as long as Black people are oppressed. It has been happening since our time in this country, and it will continue far after this moment. This is a movement.
That was Samantha Masters speaking for Black Youth Project 100 and Black Lives Matter in Washington, D.C. There's been yet another acquittal in Baltimore of a police officer in the death of Freddie Gray. We spoke with Jill Carter, a member of the Maryland State Legislature, who's also a defense attorney and who hails from an activist civil rights family. Carter says, given that cops are so seldom charged with crimes against black civilians and hardly ever convicted, lots of folks were not surprised that it looks like no one will pay for the fatal injuries to Freddie Gray's spine while in police custody.
It's sad, but unfortunately true. I think that the majority of people in Baltimore in particular and across the nation have been watching the officers charged in the case of Freddie Gray were charged with assault, misconduct in office, and second-degree murder, some of them. And seeing acquittal on not one or two, but every single charge has really led people even to a greater belief that there is no ability to hold officers accountable for any criminal conduct when they're performing their duties as an officer, which is a real blow, I think, to the psyche of the city and the country, because I think that people here had a great deal of hope. In fact, I know that we did, that finally the officers in this Freddie Gray murder would be made an example of, and that finally we could see some justice, even when officers are acting, you know, under color of law and under the guise of their duties. It's all around very, very sad day for everybody, because my greatest fear, and I think it's a legitimate concern and fear, is that police officers, and I've even seen it here with the head of the FOP union here, becoming more arrogant, more cocky, that they are untouchable. And not only that, but vilifying the current state's attorney and anyone that would deign to question what officers' conduct is while they're in office.
One of the reasons the morale of the protesters was at least at one point so high is because they thought that finally they had a prosecutor who was on the people's side in the person of Marilyn Mosby.
Yes, they believed that. In fact, Marilyn Mosby herself told the people that when she held the press conference indicating that her office was conducting its own investigation and charging these officers and that justice would be served and that she heard the cries of the people for justice. So definitely, based on the actions, but also the state's attorney's own words, people here had hoped that finally they would see some justice when it comes to police officers and extrajudicial killings, not to mention all of the random brutality that happens every day.
And how would you rate the performance of the prosecutor's office?
You know, I'm hesitant to be super critical because, again, I'm not trying those cases. What I would suggest, while the state attorney was, I believe, well-intentioned, I think that there was a rush, possibly a rush to charging and a rush to prosecution. It's been a failure, but I also think if I were the prosecutor, I would have charged a little differently. I would have probably conducted a more thorough investigation. I think the state's attorney was under tremendous pressure. She was brand new. She was young. She was a black woman. I think that she felt that it was incumbent upon her to act in a way that could possibly bring some peace to the city. Unfortunately, that hasn't turned out to be successful for a prosecution in these cases.
What are the acquittals involved the officer who was charged with acting with depraved heart, which is the Maryland equivalent of homicide that stems from depraved indifference to human life? Lots of legal experts thought that bringing charges of depraved indifference to human life against cops might be a more effective way to approach police brutality, but it didn't do the job this time.
It certainly didn't. And, you know, it's interesting because one of the things that I noticed was not charged that is usually charged in every single criminal case where there's an idea that there's criminal enterprise or meeting of the minds or agreement or, frankly, more than one defendant is usually conspiracy charges. And so what I believe from what I've heard and read is that it's been difficult to pin down what specific actions or inactions were conducted by what officers. And so I think that perhaps having that catch-all of conspiracy may have been helpful to at least be able to prove that between them something happened that caused the death of Freddie Gray. But I think that, you know, from what I've read and what I've heard, it's been too difficult for the prosecutors to prove that there was any specific action or inaction on the part of any officer individually that caused the death of Freddie Gray.
These cops have opted to get a trial before a judge rather than a jury. Do you have anything to say about that judge?
Judge Barry Williams. It's interesting because, let me be clear, I've heard a lot of things about Barry Williams recently and from the people, of course, somewhat negative. But interestingly enough, I've known Barry Williams for a long time. Before he was even on the bench, he was an attorney at the Department of Justice. I thought that if anyone would be able to meet justice out in these cases and look at civil rights violations, look at everything from unconstitutional arrest to murder, it would be Barry Williams. So I can say that even though I haven't been participating in the trial, and so it's difficult for me to second guess the conclusions he's come to because I wasn't there, it's very disappointing, and it sets a terrible precedent for the future.
Now, this saga has not yet played out, but how would you sum up the legal experience, the post-Freddie Gray death experience in the legal arena?
I'll tell you, interestingly enough, and I'm not sure how much people know this, after the death of Freddie Gray, the police officers, some say, went on strike, but essentially, arrests were down by astronomical numbers over the last year since the death of Freddie Gray. Officers just weren't making arrests. Now, some speculate they were afraid to make arrests, and others say they were just too angry to do their jobs because it was a retaliation against having these officers charged. But the bottom line is that arrests are beginning to soar up again, and I believe the city is going back to policing as usual. Now, granted, there are a couple of differences. We now have the Department of Justice oversight, and we have a new commissioner that claims to be committed to, you know, a sort of restructuring into some form of community policing and better training. In addition to that, we have a legislature, which I'm a part of, that passed what some call sweeping legislation on law enforcement reform. I'd say, well, at best, it does put more checks and balances and some more accountability in the equation. But I have to say that I really believe that we aren't going to see any major change anytime soon in the way that policing is conducted or in the fundamental lack of respect for Black and poor people throughout the city in certain neighborhoods or for the over-arrest of very small and minor things. I don't think that we will see that. It's possible that we may see slightly less brutality cases and actions that result in the death here, only because I think the officers are super cautious about that now. But I think everything else is going to be pretty much the same.
Maryland State lawmaker Jill Carter, what does the rise of Donald Trump say about the United States? The nation's best-known political prisoner, Mumia Abu-Jamal, files this report on the Trump trial.
Several months ago, I mentioned that the Republican Party has been morphed into the Trump Party. That transformation is now complete. Forces that stood against him have been silenced, shouted down, intimidated, or purged. When his last challenger, Texas Senator Ted Cruz, dared to suggest Republican voters should vote their conscience, yells of endorse Trump were followed by a chorus of boos when he failed to do so. He and his wife were threatened by Trump conventioneers. Republicans were rushed to the exits by angry Trumpists. The Republican National Convention was not a presidential event, but a celebration of ego, anger, and gross wealth. It is the party of Trump. The very fact that he has done so is nothing short of remarkable. Trump is, to be honest, a fair-weather Republican. His victory over the party is the political equivalent to a hostile takeover in business. You buy a majority of shares, control the board of directors, and fire those you don't want or don't need. You loot the company and leave it a bankrupt shell. The Republican Party has become a shell of its former self. It is hollow, an echo chamber of seething hatreds, mass ego, revenge fantasies, and white nationalism. It is the party of Goldwater, the party of Nixon, the party of Agnew, the party of thin-lipped anger at the change that has swept the nation since the 1960s. The convention, if it showed anything, was the thin veneer of hatred and unity and contempt against Hillary Clinton. It is united against anyone perceived as the other. It is united in fear and dread. It is against everything. It is for nothing but Donald J. Trump.
Mumia Abu-Jamal, reporting for Prison Radio. The grassroots rebellion in both the Democratic and Republican parties may bode well for the growth prospects of the Green Party and Jill Stein, their anticipated presidential candidate. Dr. Margaret Flowers is an honorary co-chair of the Greens' National Convention coming up in August, and one of the authors of a series of open letters the Greens have sent to various political constituencies, urging them to break with the two-party duopoly system.
Well, this started after we saw an interview with Alicia Garza, one of the founders of the Black Lives Matter movement, where she said that they were not supporting either Democrats or Republicans because of their failures to address issues that are important to people in that movement. And so we thought, well, we should reach out and just say that you are, you know, more than welcome in the Green Party, not only to become a member of the Green Party, but to fill leadership positions, run for office. We're a grassroots democracy type of party, and, you know, come to the convention and participate in that convention. And then when we did that, you know, we thought, oh, there are probably other groups out there that may want to know that they are welcome in the Green Party. And so we wrote an open letter also to Bernie Sanders supporters and to people in the single payer movement. That's one I've been very involved in, as well as in the climate justice movement, to let them know that there is a party that actually represents their values and whose platform is consistent with what they're demanding.
Are you anticipating an influx of disappointed, frustrated Sanders supporters into the Green ranks?
It's already happening. It's amazing. I mean, I'm running for U.S. Senate as a Green Party candidate in Maryland, and my social media jumped up significantly on July 12th when Senator Bernie Sanders endorsed Hillary Clinton. And for the Jill Stein campaign, she's the presumptive nominee for president. It's just been astronomical. Donations are pouring in, volunteers. Her social media has also really taken off, and it's just amazing to see the energy out there. And that, to me, it's really gratifying to see that people are not falling. Not so many people are falling for this lesser evil argument that they're presented with every 4 years.
Bernie Sanders was looked at as a kind of New Deal presidential candidate. Now he's folded into Hillary's camp. But the Green Party offers what you call a Green New Deal. What's that?
That's right. And that's something that the Green Party has been offering as a solution for a long time. It was a strong part of Jill Stein's campaign when she ran in 2012. And basically, it's a program that addresses some of the key issues, crises that we're facing. One, the high levels of unemployment, and then the other, the necessity for us to rapidly transition to a clean energy economy. So by doing that, by moving quickly to renewable energy, you know, it's inclusive. It includes clean transport, regenerative agriculture, creating local economies. This is going to create, she estimates, 20 million jobs. And we know that from economic studies that every dollar that we invest in green energy jobs, we get much more return than you do investing in oil and gas. So this is one major part of the Green Party platform.
So the Green Party doesn't see economic policy and ecological policy as being separate.
No, absolutely. And that's kind of a basic fundamental part of the party. Actually, you may be aware that there was an amendment offered to our platform this year by many of the Young Green groups, and it was endorsed by many of the state groups as well, that basically moves our platform to be much more explicit about the failures of the capitalist economy and why we need to move to a more kind of eco-socialist type of economy to address the crises that we're facing.
Yes, some people wonder why the Green Party doesn't put socialist in its name, since many of its policies would logically point towards a socialist type of organization of the economy.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. Yeah, I haven't been part of kind of the party structure for very long, but we've certainly worked with socialist groups. We've worked closely with the eco-socialists and System Change, Not Climate Change, and with Socialist Alternative as well, with Shama Sawant. And so there's a lot of synergy there. And who knows what's going to happen? I think that the Green Party has worked for decades in the U.S. kind of quietly building this infrastructure for a national party. I think in terms of the left parties, we probably have the best kind of ballot access and infrastructure. But we really need to bring these parties together. And it'll be interesting to me to see what comes out going forward and how we can actually build a party on the left that really succeeds. You know, we're really excited about the presidential nominating convention that's taking place in Houston, August 4th to the 7th. I'll be there as one of the honorary co-chairs. And also, it was exciting for us to see that Cornel West came out so quickly. He was a very close ally of Sanders, but after Sanders endorsed Clinton, he came out very quickly and endorsed Dr. Jill Stein, and so he'll be there speaking, as well as many other Greens. We have about 150 people running across the country in various races at all levels. So it's an exciting time, and I really encourage people to check it out and know that there's a, you know, political home for them there.
Well, the Democrats failed to put in their platform an opposition to TPP, although Hillary Clinton claims that she's against it. But the Green Party will be in the Democrats' territory, that is around the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia, not letting them forget about TPP.
That's right. We're going to be doing workshops and marches and rallies and all kinds of actions in Philadelphia to raise awareness and protest about the TPP, because the Democrats' failure to reject the TPP in their platform really shows us that we can't have confidence in them to stop it from being ratified during the lame duck session this fall. And all the signs point to that President Obama is going to try to push it through in the lame duck session. So we're going to be educating but also recruiting people, because we're building a resistance to the lame duck session and stopping ratification of the TPP. Then it's called the No Lame Duck Uprising, and people can check that out on flushthetpp.org. So far, we have almost 3,000 people who've signed up and thousands that are willing to come to D.C. and protest to stop that.
Why is the lame duck session after the November election their window of opportunity to push TPP through?
Well, the TPP has been a project of President Obama since he took office in 2009, and he really wants to see it completed during his final term. There's a great article showing kind of the financial ties to who's going to benefit from the TPP and who's donating to his three presidential libraries. And the lame duck session is traditionally a time during Congress when members of Congress are very unaccountable. It's after the election, so many of them have lost their seats or are retiring. And so they're just looking for their next job, you know, with a lobbyist or whatever. And so they're more beholden to the moneyed interests than ever. And so this is a really, to us, a very anti-democratic time to be trying to ratify something that's so controversial and so opposed by people in the United States.
And also, it's anticipated that Republicans might lose a lot of seats if Trump loses badly in the November election. And this might be the last time that they can muster the kind of support in favor of TPP. TPP, of course, is more a Republican bill than a Democratic one.
Well, that's an interesting way to look at it. I mean, I look at NAFTA and WTO, and those started under Clinton. I think that it's really a corporatist type of agreement, and then we know that both the Republican and Democratic parties are both corporatist parties, but it would, because the Democrats try to appear to be populist, it may be more difficult for them to do that without being able to blame it on the Republicans so much. But I think really the biggest thing is that this is President Obama's project, and we already saw in the platform fight by the Democratic Party that they're not willing to embarrass their president, and so they're willing to drive a global race to the bottom in worker protections, wages, and protection of the environment in order to not embarrass their president. And that, to us, is just not acceptable. And so we're organizing to stop it.
Dr. Margaret Flowers, speaking from Baltimore. Bruce Carter used to be an organizer with Black Men for Bernie before Sanders capitulated to Hillary Clinton. Carter says he's through with the Democrats, but he will be in Philadelphia this week when Clinton accepts her presidential nomination.
For me, there's not a vote that's required until November the 8th, whatever the date is this year. I will continue registering voters. I will continue educating voters throughout the process, especially in those swing states. And I will make sure that there's just no automatic allegiance to any one party. You know, I have no love relationship with the Democratic Party at this point, for sure. But I'm going to wait it out and see what happens. And I will be one of the many that will not be involved with the Democratic Party as a whole, for sure. We have 10 events that we're doing, and they were never subject to who was being nominated. They were subject to the sheer number of mass number of people that's available in the city of Philadelphia that's already struggling, and those that will come. And our events were labeled We the People Restoration Rallies, where we were talking about inequalities, lack of ownership, and using Philadelphia as a model as to why we need to do more and can never be totally dependent upon a government that has proven year in and year out that it's not working. So we want to make sure that people understand that if there's going to be a true level of change, that it comes from within the communities and the people that's on the ground. And that's what we're going to continually building. And we're in the process now of building the people's White House in Florida. So we have a White House that functions for the people and it's made up of by the people and that is financially supported of the people. And we will address those issues that so many hoped Washington's White House would solve. And that's what we're doing currently.
Well, give us some more details. What do you mean building a people's White House in Florida?
We have a White House that is in Florida, and it is being built, at, like I said, as we speak, with its own media component, with its own membership base, with its own platform addressing money and politics, income inequalities, climate change, community policing, and at the end of the day, find all the commonalities that we have across the country and highlighting those and reaching across party lines as we are a non-political White House. We do understand that there are things within America that we do need to address. So whether a person is a Republican or independent or non-voter or a Democrat, we're saying that there are some things that as people we can focus on and come together on. And then hopefully as we progress, when we talk about a revolution, it's about having that real core change that lasts for generations, just like the Declaration of Independence that came out in 1776. It was a real result of a revolt, and the reception has been overwhelming. I've sat at the table in Florida with Democrats who support Hillary Clinton. They know I do not support her in any way, shape, form, or fashion. At that same table, we've had Trump supporters. That same table, we've had non-voters. And at that same table, we've had progressives. And we all left there agreeing that we need to have a place that we can trust, that's not ran by hedge funds, not ran by major corporations, but it has a common goal, and that is to restore life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness for everyone. And there are levels that we are at in life that determines exactly what we can do to benefit that group. Example, if we have a group of young people in a city who have very few skills, they have not received training, they are not employable. But on the other hand, we have people who have the finance, but they're waiting 3 weeks for a plumber. They're waiting a month for an electrician. And we have those same individuals who owe child support, putting together collective efforts that the needs can be met by those that are financially able. It saves them some money, and it gives them the convenience that they can pay for. And on the other hand, for those who lack, they now know that they're able on a daily basis to have income if they're willing to earn it. The same thing for the guy that owes child support. The minimum is $120 a month. But throughout the course of that month, he really doesn't have a job. And he's going to be incarcerated or something, a license taken away at some point. We know there's five people that are paying $30 to Moore Yard. He never gets the money. It goes directly to the child support agency. So now he doesn't have to worry about that. His kids are being served. And someone in that community feels good because they were able to help someone, but it didn't interfere with the natural flow of money. So we're just talking about some common sense things that we're finding that so many Americans across the country agree with.
Sounds like you're talking about an alternative economic arrangement as well as just a political race in 2016. There have been lots of estimates about how many Bernie Sanders supporters would go along with Hillary Clinton. From your work, what do you think the percentage is?
You know, it depends on the setting and almost the time of the day that people feel one way or the other. But I would say if I talk to 10, and depending on the area they are, depending to the depths they were involved, for those that were super volunteers who were deeply within the organizations I see 9 out of 10 not voting for her. For those that were inspired because of the education piece, for those that were inspired for something that touched them, I see maybe 6 out of 10 voting for her. But for those that have been educated on her and understand the work that she has done, I see 0 voting for her. There are people who have hardline reasons why they can't support her. And I don't see them changing because that hasn't changed. I think that maybe along the way that there were some opportunities, because 4 months ago, a little over 3.5 months ago, I would have voted for her. I'm from Texas. That's all we knew. I didn't know who Bernie Sanders was 3.5 months ago. So I would have voted for her. But I think that as this process went on, when there were voting irregularities, when people's vote was being totally disregarded, I believe that as a candidate for the Democratic Party, there were moments she could have came in and stole the spotlight and said, hold on, I don't care who's voting for who. At the end of the day, this is about a Democratic voter. We need to make sure that these votes are applied properly and through the process that we, being Americans, can respect. Instead, it was allowed that so many of these Secretary of States and governors that endorsed her pre-voting were part of the problems, and that never happened. And it made people enraged, and it even made them seem that she had been placed on a pedestal. And I've heard this word, that she's not elected, that she's selected, and that our government has no value for people, and it's all planned, and it's beyond rigged, it's a conspiracy. And when you have that thought process, there's this natural sense of rebellion that comes up against you. And whether it's fair or unfair, people start to see you as the greatest villain of all. Or when Bill Clinton goes and meets this attorney general on a tarmac, you make so many people furious, but you also make people fear you because it appears you are above the law. So I believe some of the actions that has taken place has harmed them more than they've helped them, but it's made people believe that you are like a goddess and no one will stop you, and we the people have to stop you. Those are some of the internal problems that I see that will hinder, hamper, or basically make this presidency for the Democratic Party very hard to achieve.
Well, just as you hadn't heard of Bernie Sanders maybe 4 months ago, lots of folks, especially black folks, have not yet heard of Jill Stein and the Green Party. Dr. Cornel West has endorsed Jill Stein. I'm sure that you've thought about these issues.
I have been courted by people from the Green Party who may be on a lower ticket or have met Ms. Stein and have asked me what would I do if Bernie didn't get the nomination. This was early on. And here's what I told them, is that until Bernie Sanders is no longer an option, you know, that's where my loyalties lie. And I am always of the position that I'm trying to win. I'm a winner. So I'm trying to always figure out the strategy to win. If Dr. Cornel West endorses her, I believe it gives her another notch of being real, because he's a very real brother. I expect some more endorsements to come out for her. I think the 29th or the 30th of July will start to be a tell-all story for where people are going and how this race is going to shape up. But I will say this, in the event that the Green Party and Dr. Stein can gain momentum and get more people to know about her, I think it only sets up a greater failure for the Democratic Party. So in my opinion, if that's a way that we decide to go, and we have 3 months or 4 months to help the world know who she is, I think that she has a great chance of getting a very high percentage of votes. Will she get the required votes to win the presidency? Probably not. But will she get the required number of votes to dismantle a corrupt Democratic Party? I believe so.
Bruce Carter, formerly of Black Men for Bernie. The Olympic Games kick off next month in Rio de Janeiro, but Brazil is in political turmoil. The impeachment trial of the country's elected president, Dilma Rousseff, of the Workers' Party, is set to begin in mid-August. The corporate media in Brazil and in the United States act as if Rousseff's removal is a done deal. However, a federal prosecutor has ruled that the charges against Rousseff do not constitute a crime, and it's believed that there may be a large enough block in the Brazilian Senate to prevent her ouster. Maria Luisa Mendonça is director of Brazil's Network for Social Justice and Human Rights and a professor of international relations at the University of Rio de Janeiro, which has been closed down since the so-called soft coup.
We are calling it a coup because, first of all, there is no accusation of any crime against President Dilma, and the Brazilian public prosecutor already demonstrated this. So I think that's a very important point. But the problem is that the interim government is acting very fast to transform main institutions in the country. Just hours after taking power, the interim government eliminated very important institutions, including the ministries of human rights and racial equality, women, agricultural development, communications, culture. And what we see also is an increasing repression against social movements, against indigenous people that are mobilizing to fight for their land. So it's very important that the international community pay attention and understand what is happening in Brazil.
What does it say about the forces behind this coup that they would move so immediately against those ministries that deal directly with issues of importance to indigenous people and Afro-Brazilians and women?
Yes, exactly. It's to stop demonstrations against the government. It's to prevent that the Brazilian society would mobilize against what is happening in the country, because this interim government has very low popularity. If we had elections now, Michel Temer won't get even 2% of the votes. So they need to utilize repression because they have been supported by the most conservative forces in the country, very far right wing evangelicals, for instance, that would be against any rights of workers, of women, of indigenous people. So it's very serious, and it's very important that people understand, the international community understands what's happening.
In the weeks and months leading up to the coup, it seemed that the right wing had control of the streets.
Well, at that time, what was happening is that we had a serious problem of media monopoly in Brazil. All the TV networks were calling for demonstrations against the government and broadcasting those demonstrations live all day. So there was a lot of manipulation. But if you look at the photos of those demonstrations, it's basically middle-class white people. So the low-income communities that benefited the most from social programs during President Dilma's administration did not participate in the demonstrations. So it was much more orchestrated by the mainstream media. And also there was a lot of manipulation of the facts. So that's why it's important that the international media is being much more accurate in reporting what's happening in Brazil.
Yes, and the interim cabinet is entirely white and male in a country that is half African descended and, of course, half female.
Yes, and I think one important thing is that when the interim president, Michel Temer, started to receive criticism because of that, he tried to hire or appoint some women, and many of them just refused to participate in this government, which is a good thing. I think we cannot see this as a legitimate government. And I think it would be important if the international communities and other countries also do not recognize this government.
A militant black movement seemed to come rather late to Brazil, but it succeeded in winning affirmative action in education. But that program seems to be in danger as well.
Yes, exactly. Michel Temer has announced that he would cut several types of investments in education and healthcare. And one policy that has been very successful is affirmative action programs in universities, in public universities especially, but also the government had important funding to grant scholarships to low-income students in private educations, in private universities. So all of that now is under threat, all of those programs that have been very successful. And Brazil remains a very unequal country. And these policies will bring more inequality and more instability.
And for the indigenous population of Brazil, the coup has meant, predictably, more violence.
Yes, the interim government appointed someone connected to the military as the head of the National Foundation for Indigenous People in Brazil, someone who praises the military dictatorship of the 1960s. So this is the kind of people that he is appointing for key positions, very hard right-wing. And we have now this conservative, dangerous discourse of some people that want to see the same type of repression that we had during the military dictatorship that started in 1964 and lasted for more than 20 years. So it's a very serious situation. And if we don't fight against this, if there isn't resistance, and we are not able to restore democracy in Brazil, this could have a very serious impact in the whole region.
Yes, that is the question. If the interim government begins to unravel, what are the dangers of them resorting to a military takeover, straight out?
Yes, we don't know exactly what will happen. You know, there is a great deal of uncertainty in Brazil, but this is what we call a parliamentary coup, but it doesn't mean that at some point we won't see greater situations of repression. It's already happened against indigenous people. There have been hundreds of indigenous people killed just in the last months. So I think we need to pay attention to what is happening now in Brazil, and especially during the Olympic Games, because while we have public health and education in a situation of collapse in Rio during the Olympic Games, the government is going to spend millions of dollars in security against protests. So the international community needs to pay attention to what is happening there.
Here in the United States, we've been given the impression that the ultimate impeachment of Dilma Rousseff is basically a done deal. But we hear reports recently that there is a substantial block in the Senate that might be able to block that impeachment.
Yes, exactly. All the efforts from the opposition parties and the conservative media is to play down the important evidence now that would discredit the whole impeachment process and to make people believe that this is a de facto situation. So that's why all these efforts in Congress, all these efforts to build solidarity internationally, all of this is very important.
And in terms of mobilizing folks in the street, that is opposition to this coup, is it a factor of lack of coverage by this monopoly media that we don't see much of it here in the United States, or something else is happening here?
Yes, this is part of it. We don't see coverage of the protests against the interim government and against the coup. What we see now basically comes from the alternative media, which is much better coverage. But the majority of people in Brazil watch the main TV networks, and they're all supporting the coup.
Some organizers here would think that the Olympics is a perfect set piece for the opposition to the coup to make their voices heard in front of the world in ways that the Brazilian monopoly media cannot silence.
Yes, exactly. I think that it will be very important to pay attention to what is going to happen during the Olympic Games, knowing that people in Rio are having serious problems with cuts in social services, in healthcare, in education. The State University of Rio is being closed for more than 4 months now. So the main services are under collapse, and at the same time, the government is spending millions of dollars on security, which probably will mean repression against protests. And at the same time, we have been seeing lots of protests in other types of events, like soccer games, large concerts. So I think this is going to continue, and we hope to have more media coverage of those protests.
Many folks suspect that the long arm of Washington was involved in this so-called soft coup in Brazil.
Yes, we hope that this time the U.S. administration, the Obama administration, will do the right thing and say very clearly that they support the democratic process that elected and re-elected President Dilma Rousseff. They already made a very serious mistake in Honduras, and what we see in Honduras is a great deal of repression, poverty, inequality. The country is in a huge crisis, and I think it would be a very dangerous precedent to undermine democracy in such an important country as Brazil.
Well, surely there are lots of folks in Washington who are glad to see the B disappearing from BRICS.
Well, I think that it's not in the interest of the United States to destabilize a region as Latin America. I think that it would be much better for the United States government and society to have a continent, a whole hemisphere, when people have basic rights, when we have more social and economic equality. I think this is going to benefit everyone, all countries, because whatever happens internationally will have an impact, a negative impact internally as well in the United States. So I think it's important that the U.S. government understands that it needs to play a positive role and change its policies that have been creating instability in the region.
The U.S. government, of course, famously spied upon not just Dilma Rousseff, but the Brazilian oil company from whence many of the scandals emerged.
Yes, exactly. I think that's just one example why many people in Brazil are suspicious of the role of the United States, especially because U.S. oil companies are interested in having priority in exploiting the oil reserves, the offshore oil reserves, which can also have a huge environmental impact. And so far, the policy under President Dilma was to limit the oil exploitation by multinational corporations and giving priority to the national company Petrobras, which also means that there would be more control over how that oil exploitation would happen. So the new government is about to open up the Brazilian oil market for multinational corporations, which can cause a huge environmental disaster.
And also will wreak havoc with the financing of the Brazilian government, I would suspect.
Yes, exactly, because under this policy, Dilma had created a special fund, so the royalties from the new oil reserves will have to be invested in education. So it will be really important for Brazil to have control over those resources to be able to build a good base on public education. So without that, the country will not have any resources to deal with severe inequality, poverty, and other problems that are historical demands of the Brazilian society that they need to be addressed.
Which seems to be the aim of the coup plotters.
Yes, one of the main reasons is to implement a very conservative neoliberal agenda, cutting social programs, investments in education and healthcare, and implementing austerity measures. So that's one main goal of the coup. The second one is to stop investigations of corruption against the politicians that are in power right now.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host, Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.
You've been listening to the Black Agenda Report on the Progressive Radio Network. Information for liberation.